Welcome to True Confessions of a Sales Leader. I'm Scott Olson. In today's episode, we're joined by Tom O'Keefe, a seasoned executive who has made the remarkable transition from sales leader to CEO. Join us as we delve into Tom's captivating journey, uncovering the importance of embracing curiosity and adaptability in achieving success. Get ready to be inspired and discover valuable takeaways that you can apply to your own career. Welcome to another insightful episode of True Confessions of a Sales Leader. I'm Scott Olson, founder of the Olson Group, and I'm thrilled to be joined by our special guest, Tom O'Keefe, who I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with since the early 2000s. Tom is a CEO, board member, operating partner in private equity, and of course, we love the fact that Tom came up through the sales side of the business. Tom works with a number of early and growth stage software companies, both in operational and board roles, where he leverages his business experience acquired at Fortune 500 and startup companies. Tom has a passion for the promise of technology as a catalyst for human performance and connection, and brings a refreshing approach to enterprise building. Tom has repeatedly demonstrated the ability to transform concept into reality, and most recently as CEO of Centrio, which was just acquired by MitroTech, which was a huge win. So Tom, I'd like to go back to your early days when you decided to go into sales. Why did you choose sales?
We're digging right in. Well, thank you for having me, Scott. Let's just say great to be here. Always nice catching up with you. And I guess I appreciate you giving me the chance to share a little bit of the story here. It has been a fun, if at times chaotic, ride from AE at ADP back so many years ago to now a couple of CEO exits and some work with some pretty great companies and private equity partners. So appreciate it. You know, when you asked me to be on the show, I got to thinking a little bit about that history and how did it all happen. I think what people would refer to as a salesy personality. And I think most of my life, whether it was my family watching my father who was in sales, and ultimately had a brief and somewhat failed attempt at sales leadership in my teen years, to the various teachers and guidance counselors who might have suggested that based on my chatty personality, I don't think they meant it as a compliment. Pretty sure it was a slight and a backhanded compliment at best. But people who are prone to talking, sharing ideas, sometimes appropriately or inappropriately, that those things would lead to some career in sales. And a former bartender who spent a lot of time during college, it was my part-time jobs in college included bartending and lifeguarding in the summer. Somewhere along the way, I enjoyed interacting with the community. And, I think those things were obviously, as I finished up undergrad and was looking for a job, that it would be probably in some type of sales role, advocating for a business in the marketplace. And so the various inputs into my life, I think the person probably who gets the most credit for my first job was a good friend from high school who's graduated a few years earlier, was friends with my sister. And he was one of ADP's top salespeople, major account salespeople. And he was an amazing guy. And I was pretty impressed with his path. He'd already bought a home by the time he was like 20s, mid-20s in New Jersey, where I lived at the time. And he was very committed to me joining ADP, and I think maybe I should have been more determined to go find my own path. But, often we're influenced early in our lives by the people around us. And he really wanted me to work there. So he got me in the interview process. And I guess right out of the gate, met with my first rejection and failure, things you need to overcome in sales. I applied a couple times to ADP. And both the first two instances, they opted to not move forward with me. And I had a lot of work to do in terms of how I represented myself and how to acquire that job and how to make sure that they felt comfortable that maybe the obvious natural skills that I had, were going to translate for them. By the third time around, I was fortunate that I took a fairly aggressive path and just said, hey, give me your worst, most underperforming territory. And the result of which they were like, fine, you can have Ocean County, New Jersey, this remote southern territory for the North Jersey office that no one wanted because you had to drive, I remember, 88 miles to and from the remote office. And then in that office, I felt it sound like one of those old people now who's, walked to school uphill both ways through the snow. But, for me personally, I remember driving there and I got this, after graduating college, I got a Jeep, Wrangler, thought it was pretty cool. felt great driving around in the fresh air of Ocean County and with my roof off and hustling payrolls. And I would drive, because at the time we didn't do a ton of telemarketing. We did a lot of early work in door to door. And we, you know, I would drive hundreds of miles a day in my territory, along with the 176 miles round trip from my home to the office. So I think that year I put on 30,000 miles in 12 months in my car. So kind of a road warrior sales guy, first job, but it was an amazing experience because we're all lucky. If you're lucky enough to be working for a big company, and I do advise often for people not to go to startups as their first job, but to go into some kind of larger corporation. We had very structured training. I've developed this. That's why we got to know each other through my, passion for quality and developing people. Mm-hmm. They had a great program and it was very compelling. A couple months in territory, if you succeed at a certain level, you got to go to corporate training. Corporate trainers could fire you, which I always thought was a pretty interesting thing. I think in some companies, if they run you through the gauntlet for 3 weeks and you don't perform, I think they had every, option to get rid of you.
Oh yeah. IBM was notorious for that. Yeah. The guy next year doesn't come back the next day necessarily.
Totally. And it was, it was a lot of pressure, which, as we get into talking a little more about my background, I think, at times that was where I cut my teeth, was under this fairly intense, pressure-filled environment of a large company, that sold into the mid-market, payroll and 401k benefit solutions. Grace of God, I made it through those things and we're able to get in back into the territory, succeeded in my first AE role, got a promotion.
Well, just to interrupt, that is, it must have felt awful to get rejected, but that sounds like one of the biggest blessings. Of course, you didn't just run away, but you came back and retooled, because I could imagine thinking, hey, everyone's telling me I'm going to be good at this. I can talk. You're just going to walk right into it. And they're like, no. And then you're like, whoa. So that was, they say the best companies start during a recession because you have to be really, really strong. And I think in hindsight, that was probably a huge blessing.
Well, if getting rejected and told no is ultimately fodder for success, then I certainly have plenty of it, because as we journey through this discussion, you'll probably hear more about, various failures as well. And even in the successes, we fail all the time. And I think when I was looking also in preparation for this, I was going through my 16 personalities personality test. You probably are familiar with it. I'm an ENTPA. For those of you out there know me, that's probably zero surprise. I'm not sure I even had to take this test to get to that outcome, but, heavily extroverted, pretty assertive. And then what I think ultimately why I, in the long run, played out as a broader set of skills beyond just being a passionate advocate for product and services, is that I sit right in the middle on a lot of the other scales around intuition, thinking, prospecting versus judging. I'm pretty 50-50 in a lot of the trait categories. So I think that allowed me to move beyond the sales team. But, in the experience world, at least I started as an AE. I moved up into like a major accounts role. I love the competition. I love the recognition of winning, of beating your quota, of being compared to your peers, which, it's maybe not as in vogue today, but we had leaderboards everywhere, national, regional, and local leaderboards at ADP, where you were constantly being compared to other people in your same job, and then club trips and winning contests on a quarterly basis. All those things, I think, were very informative to the kinds of businesses that certainly the way I ran them early, as we got to know each other at Ethics Point here in Oregon, we were very competitive in that framework. I think, really worked well in the 90s, 2000s, maybe even 2010s. Today we're a little bit more adaptive to sort of the current state of things. And sales has changed dramatically. I think the types of personalities that can be successful in sales has expanded. We don't only look for former athletes that are used to competing. There's a lot of different ways to contribute and to advocate for a business more thoughtfully. So, but I had a fun early part of my career. ADP also allowed me to move to Oregon. I was able to transfer from North Jersey into Portland, Oregon in the early 90s, and met some amazing people that I would say also, Scott, again, in the inputs of your life, when I got to ADP in Portland, which is surprising, it's such a small market that we would have had the number one national account rep and the number one major account rep nationally, along with half a dozen other sales leaders who went on to really run amazing sales organizations, public companies, so the people around me, I'm incredibly blessed and continue through this day. I could go to every role and every board and every investor. There's so many amazing people who have invested in my career when at times they probably should have kicked me to the curb, but didn't. And continued on that journey.
Well, I want to build on that because you were a founding member of the group we started back in 2008. It happened to be during a recession. We didn't know it when we started it, though, of the PDX Sales Leadership Group. And I think some of your gifts and skills really added to those conversations. And you've been a big supporter over the years of that because you were so open, you know, almost seemed fearless, just sharing what's on your mind. Now, not everyone agreed with you all the time.
Totally.
But people trusted and they liked the fact that you always shared what was on your mind. And then that could lead to a healthy debate and a conversation and help people think differently. So I've been recently reading a book titled Fearless Leadership by Alan Weiss. And I thought, you know, this title seems to describe your style and approach to business, perhaps life. So I wanted to ask, would you agree to that? If so, why? And if not, why not? Or is there a better descriptor?
I guess people probably would say, you know, from the outside, you know, I'm somewhat fearless. Certainly, maybe the negative term would be overconfident, Scott. You've seen a lot of bluster. Appreciated. Yeah, I love that group. You know, that group is really an interesting thing. I hadn't thought about that because, you know, as somebody who is a continuous learner, you'll see in almost every company I've run, one of our core values would be curiosity. Candor would also be in there, and then, you know, be a great teammate, all the other things. But like, I value curiosity at the highest level and I value candor at the highest level. And that, both of which, you know, on a curiosity basis, I think I was wildly curious about other sales leaders and was fortunate when we met that you had a shared passion and you were building your business around sales leaders. So it was opportunistic of me to sort of partner with you and get to know so many amazing leaders here in Portland and beyond and to understand how they thought about building revenue models and hiring and promoting and training. And at the time, as you know, we could also talk thematically about the shift in software and technology sales moving from premise-based solutions to cloud-based solutions and how that affected if you wanted to be a revenue leader. If you put the distinction, Scott, I'm not sure you do this, but I think pretty clear there's a distinction between being a revenue leader and being a sales leader. I think as you shift, if you think of the various shifts you're going to go through, you go from salesperson to sales manager. You're basically doing the same job that you otherwise would have done in your own job, but you're helping others succeed at the exact same thing they used to do. And we can talk about the pros and cons of the top salesperson becoming the sales manager. Doesn't always work out. And one of the observations of those amazing guys at ADP that I was referencing when I moved to Portland is neither of those two people went into sales leadership. They were the very best salespeople and were incredibly self-aware that what they wanted was to be the best salesperson. And they had zero aspiration to be the CEO, VP of sales, whatever. In fact, I would say even the business, you could see the distinction almost the most clearly in that company that the sales managers had a completely different set of skills, often maligned and mocked because they were useless on sales calls, but they were great at business planning, territory planning, comp planning, things that really are critical to line up people to participate in the vision for the overall business. And they were advocates cross-department, which a lot of salespeople just care about the sales and the booking and then don't really think much about how that affects the rest of the team and ultimately the finances of the business. So I think for me, my curiosity, it wasn't enough for me to be just in sales ever because I saw all these other pieces in the company. And oftentimes those same pieces, as we approach quality and we think about training and development, and that I felt a sense of fearlessness, maybe use going back to your thing, like that I could influence those people too. And that we would have more continuity as we talked about the product and marketing. We can certainly talk about sales and marketing. And then as you move into delivery and renewal cycles, moving into, you know, the way we were moving to cloud-based solutions, now renewal cycles became a critical part of revenue management. All of that created immense opportunity for me personally to go deeper into the company, learn more, be more curious. Offer my input. Yes, they're I'm sure at times crazy, but at times, you know, like, hey, man, I know what our customers want. And even when you think about software and you think about our influence on product development and next feature, engineering's heavily should be, or at least the product team should be heavily influenced by frontline sales. But if frontline sales doesn't understand product development cycles and the cost of engineering, often you get terrible inputs from sales because they just want things to make their life easier, but they're not actually thinking about how to make it all better.
Yeah, it seems like it wasn't just winning, making the sale, excelling in sales, but because I was always curious because you were obviously tops in that, but to transition into leadership, like you mentioned, doesn't always work because it is a different additional skill set. It's great to have both, but perhaps it was that always the attitude of you didn't just want to excel, but you really wanted to be best in class. And going back to your reference on the centers of excellence, and maybe that was what appealed you also. Appealed to you to want to go into leadership and management side of things as well, not just self.
You know, probably there's a part of it everywhere. You know, selfishly, as SaaS technologies were coming to bear, there were just more inputs into what success equaled. And it went well beyond demand gen and top of the funnel sort of development and sales, it fighting with marketing over lead flow. For me, because activity has never been high on my, despite the fact some of my early sales jobs were very activity based. They always had an incredible amount of quality control in them. So the best companies spent the most time developing their people across the board. And I think you've benefited from that trend yourself because obviously you're in the training business. So it was never about 50 calls and 5 meetings and 2 new opportunities and a sale and get the percentages right and equals make your quota or beyond. It was about developing the right message, the right product, the right fit, all of that, even at ADP, you know, if that was lining up right way back in the day. And if you go through to Nextel where I worked or some other places, and clearly in the startup environment, critical that sales as the frontline voice of the company, that they were getting real-time feedback on messaging, positioning, product, and translating that into useful inputs into the business. I just felt like that was really exciting stuff. And it was filling my day. And I was fortunate because that can also be very distracting. If you're a quota carrying producer, the last thing you want is that person thinking about a million other things. And then I've had plenty of reps who spend all their time actually working on all the wrong things, thinking they want to input be an input into the business when their job, what they're getting paid to do is actually make their quota. But if you get that harmony right, you get that sort of balance right, it can be incredibly impactful. The best companies just simply have the best frontline teams offering feedback to the business on how to be more productive, more efficient, be more focused on what product next, what feature next. And I think those things then, the only thing I'd say on your question about fearlessness and how it affects my approach, as I've matured, and I hope to God I've matured a little bit along the way, because I don't think you'd probably get here if you didn't. You know, I spend a lot more time afraid today than I used to. The stakes are infinitely higher. And so in some ways, I have to remind myself to really wake up and, you know, get up and get going. And that's, you know, the big part of my theme. I just, you know, no matter how scared I am, even doing this podcast, oh God, what am I going to say? And, you know, but it's like, get up and do it. And I, you know, and I've pretty much taken that approach to my life and my career is just get up and do it. The difference is I also research and engage, and you know, again, been very fortunate to have been surrounded by so many wonderful people. And again, going back to that sales leadership group, Scott, which is an amazing group of achievers, you know, you got to get in there and mix it up with other talent that are kind of, I always think, like competing for the same jobs you're competing for. But in fact, we never really were. We were always willing to help each other because, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. If we all just got better, as you know, in that group, you can go almost top to bottom. Every one of those guys went on to do amazing things, including a couple of them became CEOs.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that not afraid, right? Not afraid to get in there and mix it up and good things happen, and especially with good people. Well, that's a good segue to, so going into that CEO role, you know, there's a great author, William Bridges, wrote a book called Transitions, Making Sense of Life's Changes. And he talks about how change is easy. It's the transitions that'll really get you. So what was that like transitioning into the CEO role? What were the biggest challenges and how'd you navigate that?
Yeah, I think a couple other things that I'd probably hit first is, one, I still, even midway through my career, I didn't have this idea that I would be the CEO. I'm not even sure that there was some moment in time where that became an obvious thing. I think like a lot of things, and you know, I may have mentioned that I have had the opportunity to lead most teams that I've been involved with. I have some sort of leadership role based on just my skills, style, and approach, and maybe a little bit of the fearlessness moment. But you know, people have to select you. You can get, you know, we've talked about this guy. You can be selected as the manager of the team, which means you're going to manage their inputs and things. Versus you're going to be awarded leadership opportunities. You're going to be given, you can't name yourself the leader of a company. You just, That is just not a thing. People will refer to you as a leader if you're leading them, by example, communicating effectively, you're authentic, and you're helping them candidly succeed. So somewhere along the way, I think I had a pretty good mental shift that I really enjoyed that. But I think a lot of it, Scott, was, as I mentioned before, is just that the technology change happened so quickly in our career. And this is, say, some from 1990 to today, a long time, but it was, you know, it was probably by 2003, 4, 5 that cloud-based solutions were starting to become the norm. Certainly by the late 2007, 8, 9, 10, you were, man, everything was being delivered by the cloud. I was watching Salesforce.com. And I think that continuous learning approach and a mindset, the mindset shift was like, I gotta learn more. If I'm going to influence messaging, I need to understand marketing, which was the first thing that was really the biggest leap in a moment of mind shift and ultimately this harder transition was like, okay, I want to own the messaging, because here I am doing the sales leadership now and I'm developing sales teams and, you know, I'm on comp planning and all the other stuff. So I'm starting to get into the P&L and the budgets and that's going great. But now I'm partnered with marketing, but I want to run marketing, which required a whole new set of skills, and not the least of which was, you know, obviously digital skills around, you know, paid search and organic outcomes and demand gen. Content and blogging became, you know, really important shortly thereafter. And so, but you know, if you're going to be the voice for the business, once I took on marketing, then that really unlocked a lot. And that's not an obvious shift, because a lot of times CROs today don't. If that's like you're going to own revenue, you might not actually own marketing. And, you know, but you will own renewal and delivery, because that is the revenue cycle. And you will be a much bigger input into product. So you're probably going to be on the product steering committee. So those are ones that those came much more naturally. But marketing was the area where I was very intentional about learning and developing my skills so that I could ultimately be head of sales and marketing. And then it was sales, marketing, and delivery and service. And now all of a sudden, at that point, you're running two-thirds of the company or a third of the, you know, half the company, depending on this, you know, the business. And that was pretty awesome. Now you're really an input into the business. You've got all this other stuff happening. Legal, finance, accounting, everybody else is highly dependent on the outcomes of your work. And from a budget and planning perspective, you are, you know, consuming a tremendous amount of the company's resources. So now you really have to have a better sense of finance. Now, I did have a finance degree that helped. I would, you know, I tell my own kids, even if you don't want to have a finance degree, you should take some accounting classes and some finance courses so that you can understand the basic language of building businesses. Those were the real intentional shifts. So marketing, execution, and finance were things that went along with maybe some of the things that were a bit more natural for me.
I want to shift now, take a little bigger step back now. So you are exploring a company that you want to lead. What goes into your decision-making? I know you've always been cutting edge on technology. You just love being an early adopter to find the next best opportunities tech-wise. But what do you look for in deciding what companies you want to run and lead?
See, this is great that you think I'm this intentional in my life. I would say from a career perspective, Scott, I probably would have benefited from a little bit more intention. I can get caught up in some cool things, and I my love of technology, my sort of, you know, if everything cuts both ways, if you believe in yourself, you probably believe you can do anything, and that can lead you to doing some pretty stupid stuff. So I took on some companies that, you know, didn't have maybe the right product market fit, and was very willing to look past that because it was an opportunity to take on more leadership responsibility, the CEO job in some cases. At some point that became, you know, the obvious choice. You go to a smaller company, which is typical, unless you're going to do a career play and really compete in a single company, become a, you know, a P&L holder, run a division, and then work your way up from there. Most people, if you look at the themes of careers, you end up leaving a slightly larger company and you go take the next step at a slightly smaller company. And hopefully if it goes well, you build it up and fulfill that role, and then you get more opportunity within that business. And that is largely what happened to me in many, many times in my career.
Like taking that tough territory and making
it. Yeah, it's like taking that tough territory. I got to take on a crappy company. I mean, in fair, and that, you know, that you say that you're laughing, but think about the very nature of changing a CEO or any revenue leader. I was just talking to my good friend, Mike Keister, about this. You aren't going to get if everything's going great at a company, they're not replacing the CEO. They're not replacing the CRO.
It seems so obvious now that you say that. Yeah.
You just, I mean, think about it. It's just, that's just the way it goes. Now, you know, early in your career, they're adding salespeople because it's going great. So you're coming into companies that are prospering, generally speaking, when you're an early part of your sales career. And as you go further down, you're going to probably come into companies that are struggling. Even a director or VP, why are they firing the guy or the gal who's there before you? Because something's wrong. Something's not happening that they need to happen. And they're hoping, you know, and praying that you'll come in and solve that problem. At the highest level, when they bring in a new CEO, so you're almost, you got to get over the whole idea of like, oh, I'm going to go, you know, run this perfect company. You know, I guess if the CEO passed away, I mean, I had one interview where one time somebody had a health problem and had to step away from the business. And that was like an opportunity to come into a really healthy business. But even there, they didn't necessarily, my skill set didn't line up. The fit wasn't quite right for them because they didn't need in their mind the kind of passion, energy, and enthusiasm I'm tending to bring to businesses and my point of view on revenue. What they wanted was somebody who looked a lot like the person who was already there. And I wasn't that person. So the businesses I tend to do well in are the ones that had a less energetic leader, maybe, you know, more introverted, engineering background, accounting background, not to put, you know, like profile it, but, you know, just taking big themes. And now, and they need a jolt of energy. And those are the companies I get involved with. Today, I mean, that is further defined by the investors that I work with in private equity who, you know, we bid on lots of companies. We go look at, we put in interest, letters of interest and letters of intent, and we may or may not win that deal because we may not, you know, have, you know, priced the asset correctly and we're getting outbid by another private equity fund. So, you know, and in those situations, whether I'm going to be on the board or the CEO, I'm going to be involved with that company come, you know, really regardless of my own input. I'm a part of the decision tree, but, you know, largely it's up to them. It's their money. And then they're quickly saying, okay, Tom, go run that company. I'm in categories, HR tech, compliance tech, a little bit of Marcom, e-learning, e-commerce. So you stay in these lanes that you have some depth of understanding, but generally speaking, intention. I don't sit around and go, oh, I'm going to go target that company and go take that CEO job. That's just not that productive because the CEO's there and he's probably doing pretty well.
Sure, sure. Well, take us to that. We love learning about the biggest challenges in your career. What would you say is, wow, this might be the biggest challenge that you faced and you dealt with and kind of what you learned from that experience?
Is this the true confessions moment?
This is it.
I was nervous about that title. You know, I didn't realize.
I know you're brave just to come on with that title.
I was like, wait a minute, wait, this is some confessional. You're going to be my religious leader, and I'm in the box now.
It'll be cathartic.
Yeah, I think clearly, and Scott, to some degree, had a front row seat at Ethics Point, an amazing company that, you know, so many great and talented people here in Portland, Oregon, influenced, and I had the opportunity to join them as the VP of Sales in 2003. Progressed well along the arc that we're talking about, you know, VP of sales to sales and marketing, great leaders and mentors from the CEO and the gentleman who hired me. We brought in amazing people, brought in some great consultants to help, yourself included, and ultimately became the CRO, COO of that company prior to its sale, to our first private equity outcome in my career. But ran into some real problems at the end. And I think because I wasn't adapting fast enough my style, and I watch this in other younger execs, you come up in a single channel like sales. And like we talked about earlier, you have this immense energy and focus on deal making and product advocacy, but and driving performance because, you know, and particularly in the case of Ethics Point, we only raised, I think total funding was like $4 million and, you know, ultimately sold for a little under $100 million. There were times when, you know, cash was tough and we needed sales. You had to have it or the company was going to struggle. And we didn't have the kind of people around the business that had the access to capital at the time in 2003, 4, 5. And by the time the business was going in 7, 8, when raising money was good in 6 and 7, when we didn't need it. But by 2008, when we really wanted to grow, we just didn't have the capacity to go out and get $20 million. And we didn't know what we didn't know. So I think the challenge there was more about my own personal mindset and focusing on being the kind of, let's call it even manager for a broader set of people service people, delivery people, marketing, you know, and then more and more ego gets in the way and you're just not sensitive. I wasn't sensitive enough to the various people that were influenced by my behavior, I call it behavior, but you know, my inputs and, you know, ultimately led to a fairly awkward, well, financially a great outcome, a fairly awkward career misstep that should have led to something far bigger. Cause that, as you know, that company has gone on to become an amazing business under a different, more adaptive leader who had similar early parts in his career. Cause I know him well. And, you know, would probably say the same, but in this particular chapter, he's 10 years older than me. He was more capable of being a better leader for more people, more types of people and type personality types. And I just wasn't a student of that, Scott. I was so focused on what I thought was critical in terms of driving revenue. And I'd almost say not even revenue, but sales. And I was less adaptive to the things that were driving the business. And ultimately, that just created too much of a cultural, it was like one side of the company was this type of culture and the rest of the company was another type. And I broke the harmony of our corporate culture. And ultimately, if you do that, you know, generally doesn't land well. I had a lot of people who helped me. I was influential on that business. So the financial part was protected, but the career misstep was pretty big.
Wow. Again, such a huge, valuable lesson that you've turned into something positive moving forward. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure my wife thought it was all that positive at the time.
At the time. I know. But you stayed in there. Let's shift to something, you know, I know you're passionate about, and that's technology again, but how do you stay on the cutting edge of that? And I want to get your thoughts, of course, on AI, what you're seeing there and where that's going and how that's affecting sales.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of themes there. So I think as we think about, you know, kind of, I think you put it as like running sales to running the business, or even, hey, I want to sell technology solutions to, we're going to now sell the company per se. So, you know, all kind of thematically very similar concepts. Like, I, again, good mentors. I had this joking statement I say all the time is I'm reading the book one chapter ahead. Board meetings. You know, until you're in your first board meeting, you've never been in a board meeting. So sidebar recommendation, people ask me, how do you want to become a CEO in any career? Go be on a board in a nonprofit. And I'm not talking about like your school PTA. That's fine. But I'm talking about an actual significant nonprofit that you can join a committee, build up and become a part of the board and understand governance in general. Because larger nonprofits have good governance structures today. That role will also allow you input into their CEO and leadership team, and you'll see how they operate. And you'll get. I got big looks at how leaders operate in different domains through volunteer work, which I think is really important as you think about running a company, not just being the head of revenue, but running the company. You need, again, to have a broader set of skills. And your curiosity has to lead you down different paths. And then you find a voice. And, you know, I'm still, Scott, still kind of the same guy at one level. I'm brought in because I can set a clearer vision and articulate it fairly well. I am fairly good with planning and budgeting, particularly when it comes into revenue functions. I'm smart enough these days to know to hire the right people and bring in, you know, to me, that means the CFO. Give a little shout out to my good friend Todd Henney from back in the day, who has been and continues to be an amazing resource. My most recent CFO, Andy Nguyen, out of up in Seattle. You know, you surround yourself with better people, and that allows you to continue to be great at what you're great at. You know, we all have our skills, and you know they get honed, and hopefully they cover those blind spots. We try not to use the word weakness anymore, Scott, because you know. I mean, it's true, but
blind spots more West Coast.
Yeah. It's so West Coast, you know, but it's true. Everybody has things that are naturally good at, and then things that you aren't even that interested. I even use interest now. I don't even use like, you know, I'm not good at it or not. I'm not as interested. I don't wake up thinking about, hey, I can't wait to build my monthly financial plan for my investors, you know, like, but my CFO hopefully does. And my CTO on our roadmap planning, I can give them big themes, but I don't want to break it down into sprints. But I better understand how that all works. And I think that, you know, you start surrounding yourself, you volunteer your time, you get involved with other organizations, you begin to see how other people lead. You do things like start the sales leadership group with an up and coming young consultant like yourself. And, you know, you start getting all these other inputs into your life And then, you know, you make some bad investments in some other startups because you finally have a couple bucks in your pocket. But that gives you a chance to look at these entrepreneurs, which I've never been an entrepreneur. You know, like you don't use the word with me. And I, you know, lots of people confuse that they think I'm some kind of entrepreneur. I'm not. I don't have a new idea in my head. Like I never think about that, but I'm a quick study.
But you love new ideas.
I do love new ideas, but I do. And that's why I can get enamored with the engineering startup guy who's, you know, a PhD carrying egghead who just, you know, has crazy ideas and can prototype things fast. I love that stuff. And testing and learning is big in my world. So I do love the idea of quick sprints and test and learn and see. And then I bring to the table, the ability to articulate that as some solution to a problem, hopefully a universal problem or one at scale. We can get quick feedback from the market on whether it's viable. Can we price it right? Can we build a business around that idea? But then I'm stubborn. So I can, you know, I've spent time at some startups that I just spent too long, you know, where the product market fit wasn't there and we refused to quit and give up. Plus, once you start taking investor money, you know, there's a loyalty to that that has to be there. And it can be, you know, again, shout out to you, to anyone who's in startups. You know, it's great stuff, but you know, I don't think you're stuck there, but I felt fairly at times like, hey, I have an obligation. I asked somebody for millions of dollars to bet on our ideas. I got to be true to that and stay with that. And all those things, I think, as you're journeying, as you're going back to the original premise, like what you know, went from here to there, all of these things build up to the point where you are going to be a responsible CEO. You're going to have a broad set of understanding of the various business functions that inform success. And that you're going to understand general governance around how to the framework of organizing a business and taking capital from investors and ultimately, hopefully paying it out. It's a lot of fun on the other side when everybody gets paid. But trust me, it's not fun when you run it to zero and shut it down or sell it off as an asset sale and nobody's getting paid. You better be good at some of that structural stuff because lawsuits ensue and lots of things that could happen that the sales guy will never know much about, but the CEO certainly will experience firsthand.
And where do you see AI kind of taking things? What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is one of the coolest chapters because you know, I spent a part of my career in health analytics and what we call decision support software, which is like predicting the next course of action based on a corpus of knowledge and an algorithm that would interpret that corpus of knowledge and deliver it into the billing and coding structures of a health record system as the clinician was engaging the patient, this real-time decision support. And so you're starting to see that play out in sales now, right? I mean, a little bit. What you're seeing, what we were using, and Scott, I think you're pretty well aware of some of the tools that we've been using. A little shout out to our good friends in Gong or Clary, these sort of conversational intelligence tools, which were the first real shift in natural language processing and semantic parsing that took unstructured recorded data or email data, which is all unstructured, and turned it into structured data that could be analyzed for trends and analysis and held up and compared to outcome data in Salesforce.com. So, which we didn't even talk about. We blew right over the CRM days, but you were there at the beginning. We've all transitioned to these infrastructure products in sales. And so on top of Salesforce as the primary database tool, you have all these other tools that are now recording every call in the same way this podcast is being recorded. It would be very easy to drop this file into a semantic parsing engine or natural language processing engine, not this sort of self-adaptive and learning AI, but just these large language models that let us take these unstructured recordings and turn them into structured data that can be mined for insight. You could talk about how fast am I talking? Are we pausing appropriately? Who brought up this thing first or that thing second? In our case, so Gong was incredibly interesting. When we looked at training and developing our salespeople, we're getting scorecards that hold up all of our sales reps for how much are they talking in a meeting. And we have goals that they shouldn't talk more than, say, 55% of the time. And if our reps are talking 75% of the time, and we can compare those situations to the outcome, did we win or lose, and the input, what lead, where's the lead source? Look at lead attribution, you can start to build really successful training models and developing a better approach to how we engage the market at the point of sale.
Yeah, or at least a red flag to go look at that call.
100%. Right. I mean, yeah, the deal level, the manager is looking at it that way. I'm looking at it like statistically across the entire team. And then we began deploying incremental technologies around our entire organization's interactions with the customer. So every year when we send them a bill, every year that they email us contract requests, customer service requests, ticketing requests through Zendesk or Jira, like we had all this tech infrastructure that now is getting the same like analytics layer put on top that gave us signals. In Centrio, we use this with great success. Most recently, a company called Sturdy AI, amazing business, that allowed us to look at signals of churn. If you're going to be a revenue leader, you better be thinking about churn, because if we're losing, if the market is only availing, you know, $8 to $10 million of new ARR growth to us, given our marketing inputs and sales team, but we're losing $8 to $10 million in churn, that's pretty bad business if you're the revenue leader. So shoring up your customer satisfaction, what, you know, often is net promoter score, but for me only manifests as, are they renewing? And can we, do they have, so is there some tolerance for us to increase prices? That's like the number one thing we look at. So are we renewing at a gross and net retention that is productive in our business model? Very high in SaaS software. That should be, you know, gross retention should be in the, you know, 90s, and then net should be 110, meaning current customers are expanding spend with us. You can expand through price increases or adoption of new features, but those things become the math of the business. And so AI is now giving us incredible signals into what would seem like an innocuous, here's a great example, an innocuous request for, hey, Mr. Client Service Rep, not your sales team, not your revenue team, but like, hey, you're just everyday client salesperson, you know, servicing the account. Hey, can I get a copy? Customer says, can I get a copy of my contract, my agreement? And here we have this, you know, chipper person send them this agreement. They think they did a great job. It was in positive interaction. Client was happy, got what they wanted. Everybody's winning. What do you think the number one reason somebody requests their contract is?
Yeah, they're going to compare it to some other options moving forward.
100%. Yeah. It's like the earliest indicator, maybe not the earliest indicator, problems, dissatisfaction. So then what's an earlier indicator? Another great example that we use, how often are we apologizing in those encounters to our customer? Now, that led to a couple of interesting findings and why AI isn't totally perfect. But one, we just hired really nice people who tend to start things like, hey, I'm really sorry, Scott, I was late for this meeting. Well, okay, that's an interesting signal. Why are you late for meetings all the time?
Yeah.
you know, in this case, we started this podcast. We were working on some technical stuff. Hey, I'm really sorry. Can you hear me? Is this webcast on? Can you hear me? I'm really sorry. Like, we're setting up these, we're apologizing all the time. These little micro, they're not aggressions because they're being apologetic, but they're as bad as an aggression because you're setting up this like position where you're undercutting our authority as a partner in their world by apologizing all the time. Now, an appropriate apology is, hey, we really screwed something up and you better apologize for that. And all of this goes to the technology stack, allowing us to see those things. Now, for that to happen, we have to, it's easy on email. If you're apologizing on email, that's pretty easy to pull through. But what about the countless phone calls we have with our agents across the business who don't, like salespeople, record everything? So now we have, everything is voice over IP, right? So everything has the potential to be recorded. There are laws around that, like, you know, do you need consent in certain states on both sides? But largely, we're recording, and most businesses today are recording virtually everything from chat bots online to sales encounters and emails. And we're mining that data for insights about our business and our talent. And I think for right now, if you're talking about just what pays the bills, that's amazing. That is, you can invest in those technologies with utter confidence that if you are an aspiring leader who wants to move forward in your career, you better have command of those technology stacks and how they fit in your infrastructure play, because that goes right through to finance and everything else. We need those to pay off. We're going to spend, and we spend a lot of money. In Centrio was a $20 million business from an ARR perspective. And we were spending, you know, Salesforce's bill was $150,000 a year. Gong's was $70,000, $80,000 a year. I mean, we're spending real money, you know, relative to our own profitability profile. But it allowed us to make our teams way more productive. It allowed us to have our managers manage maybe one or two more people, which gave us more leverage in the market. And all of that flows through to the P&L. So I think it's a great time. The only thing I'd also say is that one of the things I really love about Gong's evolution, Clary's evolution, is they're now taking those recordings and they're architecting the response email immediately. So the summary of the call, again, we could push this podcast through and somebody could go to ChatGPT and say, hey, just summarize the conversation Tom and Scott had on the top four things that Tom talked about. And you'll get a list. And that is the follow-up email. So here's the things we talked about. Here's the next steps. Hopefully the sales rep did that right. Here's the next steps. The customer had some objections or concerns. Those were noted. And then the response data is auto-generated as an email that's in prep for the rep so that they can go ahead and just take that email, do some small edits, and ship it. And everybody's working way more efficiently and way faster.
Great personal assistant. Yeah, get the ball rolling. You might like it. You might make some edits. And very practical. Really appreciate that. Very practical ways to leverage it. I want to transition to maybe this is kind of a double-edged sword here, because you come from the sales side. You understand it so well. Hiring your sales leader. It's probably great they know that, hey, you understand sales, but also you understand sales. That could be challenging as well. What do you look for in a sales leader? And that may depend on the business you're running, but what do you look for?
Yeah, I've said 1,000 times when I hire the head of sales, it's the hardest job in the business, not just because I think it's a very difficult job, but you know, I humbly submit that the head of engineering, CTO is very difficult. The CFOs, everybody's got hard jobs today in private equity or venture money. The gravy trains are over. It's a lot of really thoughtful work that needs to go into a business to have the outcome that everybody's looking for. On the sales side, it is difficult because I have done the job and I love the job, and I spend a lot of time thinking about messaging and positioning and product market fit, planning, territory planning, budget. So I you know, at least I've had enough experience now to stitch it all together. That, you know, that makes it really hard for the CRO. So do I need a CRO is the first question I've been asked. Do I need someone to run the whole thing, or do I need a VP of sales who's going to look more at like deal operation? How do we get territory planning to sales execution? And then I'll architect with the head of client services, the head of marketing, a broader set of initiatives that I would manage. Personality is changed dramatically depending on what you need there. In the same way that hiring the head of digital and demand gen on the marketing side is very different than hiring a CMO who's going to be your brand advocate. Really different, just different things, skills altogether. So I think one, knowing exactly what you think the business needs, and then staying pretty true to, we want to hire someone who's a really good sales operator, maybe particularly good at training and developing territory planning and analytics, pipeline management, stage management. The technologies we just talked about are increasingly important. So they better have, you know, and this is the hard part for the sales leaders in their 40s and 50s. If they're not adapting, man, you can get old in sales quick. And you always could, but right now it is, you know, the premium is you better understand how all of these technologies come together and how that informs the way you grow and develop talent, going all the way back to, you know, what's most important is we want to develop talent, but we have all these new tools to use, all of which should have a profound impact on our customer engagement and satisfaction, renewal rates, product insights. And so, you know, I think those things become the number one thing that I'm looking for. And that, you know, that leads to a very different personality type. You may not need, and candidly, in my companies, given that I'm fairly bombastic, I don't know that I need a whole bunch of other bombastic characters who want to stand on stage and talk about the business. So I'm very comfortable hiring a more introverted sales leader who's focused on process and performance and a little less on messaging and advocacy, because I'm going to have a natural inclination to help there, and we don't need to be stepping on each other's toes.
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's really, how do you build off your strengths and find the right players to really to complement the overall team? I love it. Well, so last question. This is the impossible question to answer. It'd be like if you just wrote a book and I asked you to summarize it in one sentence. But if you could give one piece of advice, and we'll talk about sales and sales leadership and then going into that CEO role, what would you give? And we'll start with a salesperson, somebody who wants to go into sales. What's one piece of advice you would share?
Anyone can do it. So anyone can be an advocate. Take sales out and say, I'm going to advocate for this product, this service, this solution, this brand. You could even go further and say, you're just being asked to share your love and passion of something with somebody else who has an interest in that something. That's it. And there's some technology and some, you know, things in the middle of all that. But in the end, I think if your heart's in the right place, you believe in what you're doing, anyone can be an advocate, because we all advocate for things in our lives, regardless of personality type. So you shouldn't be afraid of taking a job where you're being held accountable to some degree, that maybe you got to just be comfortable with accountability, but because quotas are real and goals are real and comparisons are real, but anyone can do it.
That's great. I like that. An advocate, the public face, but you're an advocate. Okay. So now sales leadership.
That one is, I'd say, be more introspective. Anyone who has a high sense of introspection can do this job. You can't do the job for your rep. So that's a short-term sales leader is the guy who's just basically the best salesperson. We surround him with order takers and lead handlers. It can be a model that's successful, but just won't scale. What you really need is be a teacher, be introspective, and be wildly curious about how to help others. And you can probably be a pretty successful sales leader.
Nice. Okay, excellent. And going into the CEO role, what would you share there?
Well, clearly anyone can do that
too. So that's the easiest of all.
Since I've done that, anyone can do it. I'd say, and I have to remind myself of this because it can be very, as you might imagine, fairly nerve-wracking. Again, in the True Confessions, when investors are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into things and asking you to be the primary leader of that business, it's, there are times when I'm like, wow, am I really going to do that? You got to walk into a company with a couple hundred employees and hold an all hands and be credible. There's a lot to be sure of, and a lot to be really candidly very scared of in that environment. You're like, hey man, I'm here for a reason. The people around me are very bright. They all went to the top of colleges and they have billions of dollars to dole out. And their job is to bet on people they think can make it happen. So, I'd say in this case, if people are giving you the kind of feedback and, promoting you, even though the Peter principle, right, you get promoted to your own level of failure is certainly in there. And we see CEOs fail at an incredible rate. It's one of the clearly most difficult jobs. Why disproportional comp plays out for CEOs. But, the average life cycle is about 3 years. VP of sales, by the way, is harder. It's like 2 years. So it's even worse. But I think, again, in the spirit of sort of anyone can do it, there's so many different personality types that end up as CEOs. But here I'd say, think about fit more than anything. And that is, again, introspection leads to your understanding of where your skills allow you to participate in a company in a very positive way versus, hey, the needs of the company are actually really different than what you're comfortable with or what gets you excited every day. And you're only taking this job because it's what's in front of you. It's very hard to turn down jobs when you need a job. I've been blessed, right now that we're in a situation where I'm having a little bit more of a chance to pick more thoughtfully. But, for me, if fit is the number one thing, where the company is in their life cycle, where the financial partners are, what's the outcome they're looking for? What is the current management team's personality set and skill set that will they react well to my input? It has to be a very honest question that any CEO should be asking themselves before they take on that job, or you're going to have to make monumental change to the business to adjust it to you, which I think is like the worst thing to do because now you're setting back the business potentially and you're hurting a lot of people's careers along the way. So I think about fit, be introspective and curious about that. And if you do that well, you probably have a pretty good chance to be successful. Assuming you have all the other skills that people believe in you, you wouldn't have gotten this far probably. I mean, we're not talking startup stuff. We're being a CEO of it. Of a two-employee company, we're talking hundreds of employees, where people, there's literally millions of dollars of budget for people, and this now you count up the families. You always do the employees time four is actually your responsibility. So if you've got 100 people, you got really 400 people that are responsible for the work you're doing and the inputs you're giving. You better care for that thoughtfully and think about the fit.
The fit, the right leader at the right time at the right place. Yeah, are you the right person to lead this company at this time? Excellent. Well, Tom, just thank you so much for sharing a lot of rich insights from someone who has the scars to prove it. And you're always learning and just appreciate your taking the time just to give and share with others right now. So can't thank you enough.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Scott Olson, founder of the Olson Group. If you found this podcast helpful and informative, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite podcast app or follow the show on Spotify. If you want to accelerate the growth of your business, the Olson Group can help. Please feel free to reach out to me directly via email at scott@olsongroup.net or call me
at 503-525-8866. Thanks again for listening.